Hello and welcome back to the Indie Film Toolkit podcast. This is episode 6. I am your host, Wade Bojic, joined by the late, great Ben Robertson.
Hey.
And David Ishida.
Nice to be here, isn't it?
Today, we're talking about a lot of awesome indie film stuff, starting with drones. We're going to go over the history of filmmaking drones and where they are today. Then, blending practical effects and CGI, the history of that and how effective it's gotten. Finally, this month, we saw Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, the new Harry Potter spinoff film. So, starting off, drones. We have a drone. We have a Phantom 3.
It's a Phantom 3 4K.
Okay.
Which they don't make anymore.
Is there a pro thing attached to that, too?
Nope. No. That's a different drone.
We got it 2 years ago?
No, not even. I think it was about a year ago.
Okay. And I will say, it's completely revolutionized what I think is possible with getting shots.
For the indie filmmaker.
Totally.
It's incredible.
But starting out, I mean, before drones, you had to basically, what, like take a film camera, 35 millimeter, like a 435 or something, and bring it on a helicopter or mount it on a helicopter. Yep. And then just, hire out an aviation crew and just go on out and hope you get the shot.
Yep.
Sure, there are companies specifically for that. Like, that is what they do.
Which, actually, I've always wondered this. David, do you know if they have Video Village in a helicopter for that?
If it was film, it would depend on the era.
Yeah.
And if they were more in the more recent, the more tail end of major filmmaking, and they had a video tap in it, they could run something in. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, modern day, absolutely.
Okay.
They either have a hard line or they have a wireless transmitter.
I guess I'm just thinking of mainly The Lord of the Rings, when they got the big sweeping shots of them walking, you know?
For that, they probably would have.
Okay.
That was shot on film. All Lord of the Rings was on film. But yeah, at that era, yes, they did have what we call video tap. So it was basically a video camera mounted on, so that when the shutter mirror of the film camera was at the right moments, it would be reflecting into that.
Right.
And then they would be able to watch.
And then I want to say 4 or 5 years ago, I started seeing a trend emerge with, expensive custom built rigs, essentially, that were drones that would carry like smaller cameras, GoPros, some DSLRs. And they would have like 8 or 10 or 12 different
blades, you know, like octocopters or decacopters.
And they looked really hard to fly. I saw one viral video online that was, I think, a guy's 5D or something that went up in like a city street and then went and it just crashed. But we've come a long way since the Wild West days. Phantom is obviously the big kid on the block here. But when did they start? Do you know, David?
It'd probably be about 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
Is when the first one came out. About 5 years. I think we're on the Phantom 4 now.
Okay.
So yeah, it would have been about 5 years ago.
The Phantom 3, the one that we have, is an incredibly powerful machine. It's lightweight. We have it in a relatively small case. And it might feel a little cheap, but I think it's just trying to be as light as possible, right?
Yeah, I think so. You know, the big thing with all drones is weight. Weight is always the big thing, because the main problem is your payload can be heavy, depending on your camera, and then the batteries are heavy. And so, you know, there's the whole thing about, you know, how much power you need to have to get enough lift, but then to do that, you need a bigger battery, so you need to be able to lift all that extra weight and whatnot.
But it's incredible, the technological advances that have come around in the last couple of years. So, you know, the camera that comes on the Phantom 3, it's a 4K camera. Mm-hmm. I mean, the sensor isn't crazy awesome, but it's good. And David reluctantly shaking his head.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you look at it, you know, again, you do your comparison. If you wanted to do this 20 years ago, and you'd probably have to spend like $20,000 a day to hire a helicopter and then fly around and do it like that, versus right now, you know, when we got ours on sale, it was $1,000, I think, for our kit with some of the extras on there. Like, the fact that we had a 4K camera that we can fly in the air, and we can get something close to the helicopter style shot.
Right. But like a clear advantage though over the helicopter is, if you want to get a shot that's coming low to the ground with a helicopter, you're going to get a lot of air that's being pushed and all
right.
that. With the drone, not so much. So we've got this 4K camera that's mounted on a few different gimbals that keeps it steady in
rough
winds. Yeah, pretty rough winds. But also, the drone itself has software to keep itself steady and in the same spot during wind.
Yep, and a lot of the, and some of that comes from the GPS satellite. So a lot of these drones, they have GPS on them, so it helps, excuse me, triangulate, or actually more than that sometimes, its position to help keep it in place. I think ours will do up to 10 or 11 connections, so 10 different satellites to figure out where it is.
It shows you on the UI.
Yep.
But it's not always perfect, though, because I remember there was a time where I took the Phantom 3 out on onto Lake Superior on a super windy day, and I just sent it out straight, and then I did that a couple of times to try to get my shot, and then when it was time for me to bring it back, I realized, oh, it's actually like 500 meters to the west.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh, crap, okay, we'll have to start bringing it back.
Yeah. Oh, and the range, I guess, that reminds me of, like, it can go, what, like a... How far away can it go?
I think ours can do about 3/4 of a mile. But what happened with the Phantom 3 line is at first there was the Phantom 3 Advanced and the Phantom 3 Pro. And with both of those, they use this special technology they call Lightbridge, which is the communication technology between for video for between the drone and the remote. Mm. And so it uses that so it has a really big range. Now, when ours came out cheaper than both of those, though the same camera as in the high-end Pro. Because instead of doing that, they just did straight Wi-Fi for it. So it has a much more limited range, but, you know, it came in at like $300 cheaper than the professional one.
It is a great bargain for what we got, but it also comes cheaper because you use your tablet or smartphone as the viewing screen.
Yep.
Which I think works pretty well. I mean, the interface is relatively easy to use, and it's touchscreen interface, and it's
less
nice
to bring along with you. You always have your phone or a tablet probably with you. The only issue is that you run into potentially battery issues.
Right, but I wouldn't necessarily worry about the battery dying on your phone first, because the flight time on the Phantom is very limited. What would you say?
On most of the Phantoms now, it's basically about 20 minutes.
Per battery?
They say a little bit more, and I think usually, like, when you pop one of ours in fresh, it says about 25 minutes. I don't count the last 5 minutes, and this is a good thing if you're flying a drone, is you really do have to be mindful of your battery and how far you are away and how long it'll take to get back.
Yeah.
I don't count the last 5 minutes. I never use the last 5 minutes, because when I hit that mark, it's just I come back immediately.
Right.
I don't putz around. I don't try and get another shot. I just come back because, you know... Though it is, you know, it's small and it's light, it's still probably, what, about 5 pounds? Mm-hmm. 6 pounds, I think. And if you're at 400 feet in the air, which is the highest you can go on by FAA rules, and that falls, and you shouldn't be flying over anybody, according to FAA rules, but if you are, you know, that's 6 pounds flying for 400 feet.
Or
even if it's not on somebody, it's then now falling 400 feet to the ground. It's not going to survive that.
Yeah, and it's good to do that, because even though I think there's software that's built in that at a certain battery level, it will just start flying back to you without, like, you, and you can't, it just takes over.
Is it back to you or just down to the ground?
It depends. I think there is an option where it will return back. It figures where it is with the GPS silos, but that's not perfect. There have been times when I've done tests in open fields where I knew I wasn't going to run into any trees. There's an option called return to home. So you can, in theory, hit that button and it will land where it took off, assuming you gave it had the opportunity to pick that as its new home point.
Sure.
And I've done it before, and it's not always off. Like, it's not off by, you know, 40 feet, but it's off by, you know, it can be off by like 20 feet or 15 feet. Mm-hmm. And so with that room margin for error, you know, if you're doing any stuff in like trees where you're like in a clearing where that could be the difference between landing in the middle of your clearing or landing in up in a pine tree, I don't like that. So yeah. I always take it in manually.
There are a lot of other features that we haven't even really used.
Waypoint.
Yeah, that's the one I'm thinking of.
Yeah, that one's really cool. I've done a few tests with it, and I've been meaning to do some more experiments to see. But it's basically, the idea is you can fly your drone along a path, pick waypoints, and then when you're finished, you basically just hit a button and it will replay that path
with whatever speed you want, which is cool.
Yeah, but with whatever speed, and also it only cares about, and this is the nice thing about why most of them are quadcopters, is because of the maneuverability they have versus doing just a traditional like helicopter where it was just one main blade and then one at the back for your turn. But with that, then you can have it fly along the path, but you can still point the camera wherever you want. You can, you know, just be spinning in a loop the whole time along the path, but it will follow the same path.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, really nice if you're needing to do a repetition of a shot, if you need to do it multiple times and you want to have it be the same every time.
Well, and it helps too when you're the sole operator of the drone too, because it becomes very difficult, at least with the Phantom line, it's a single operator, so you have to do both the operating of the drone and then the cinematography too. You have to figure out your shot and everything, and that
depends on the drone, right?
Because correct, on the Phantom line it's just yourself.
The Inspire, I think, has
two operators. Then you can, if you want to drop down the extra money, you can get a second remote, And I think then you also get a second transmitter thing that plugs in, I think, up at the drone end. But then you can have one person that is only flying and one person that is only doing camera.
Yeah.
But that being said, one thing that we try and do, if we're out, you know, just flying for fun, then we don't do this. But if we're doing a production, the way we've done it, just from a safety standpoint, is we always have two people that are operators on the drone. One person that is concerned with flying it and doing the camera work. The other person is a spotter. And so we just have them watch the drone. So in case, you know, if there's a point where we need to take the drone behind a tree or something where we don't see it, the spotter will move over, so we always have eyes on the drone.
Yeah.
Because again, we don't want that drifting off somewhere it shouldn't, or if, you know, it's far off and we can't say, oh, actually, we're a lot closer to a tree than we thought.
That's a really important role to have.
Or hawks.
We were doing a shoot for another type of video that we'd like to do. It was called a Let's Learn series, where we had David run out in his full Indiana Jones gear. And it was a cool drone shot, but he also had to be the spotter.
Yep. Yeah, but yeah, and as I said, that's important, especially if you're near people or potential obstacles for
right.
it.
We've covered a lot on the Phantom line, but also GoPro announced their Karma drone this year, and they tried to release it, but it was unfortunately fully recalled.
Yep. Which there's a lot of people that are saying, oh, this is terrible. Like, how could they do this? One thing pointed out was, like, when the first Phantom came out, there were similar problems. I don't think they went into a full recall, but mm-hmm. there were plenty of issues. Like, if it would be stranger if GoPro had a perfect drone launch.
Yeah.
You know, get into this. Because, yeah, it was recalled because it was losing power, and I think they were saying that there may have been something to do with how like a connection to the battery like was jostled loose with vibrations.
Oh, sure.
Or something. Because on the Karma, one of the cool things about it that I like is you mount the GoPro at the front of the drone, so you're ahead of the blades, which is one thing with the Phantoms, they're all underslung, so if you're going fast enough forward, the rotors will tip into your shot,
right?
And I think the idea was that because the Karma has the GoPro mounted at the front, the computer in there has to work a lot harder because it's front heavy, so it wants to tip forward. Mm. And with some of the vibrations associated with that, it was jostling batteries and it would lose power and fall
into the ground. It's from a conceptual standpoint, it's a cool design because it's effectively a GoPro Hero 5 on its gimbal stick system that you can remove from the Karma and just like carry it around on like a snowboard or something, and then snap it back in and take off.
Yep.
So that part's really cool, but
and it folds up. That's another thing too. With it folds up and you can leave the rotors on also.
Oh,
when you
sure.
fold
yeah,
it up.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's small. It connects into a nice space.
Not as small as the Mavic. These names. Not as small as the Mavic, which is Phantom's newest, smallest drone.
Yep, yeah, and that one's sort of positioned. It's sort of, though it has some really amazing capabilities and the range is really nice, I think it's sort of set up at the bottom of their spectrum as far as the quality. I think, you know, if you go up into the Phantom 4s or the Inspires, you're going to get better cameras.
So it's the most introductory, I guess?
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, base cost for that is a grand, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. For that. With that one, though, it doesn't come with a remote. With that, you have to use just the smartphone as the controller. I think you have to go up to a different kit before it comes with the remote control.
Oh, interesting. Casey, I forget his last name.
Casey Neistat.
Yeah, he was one of the first guys to get the Mavic, and he was like, I can fit it in my pocket. I mean, it was obviously sticking out of his pocket, but...
Yeah, it's small. You know, it's about the size of, I don't know, maybe Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire.
Like the book?
Yeah, the book.
Oh.
Yeah. So I'm trying to tie it into the movie later. I was bringing in Harry Potter.
Oh.
I thought it was pretty slick.
Yeah, that was spot on segue that we're not segueing to
well,
yet.
Well, no. The nice thing about those small drones is that you can just bring them whenever. They have a super small footprint. Because like the issue with our drone is that you have this huge, big Pelican case that you have to schlep around. Like, you can't just throw it on your back and take it up a mountain. You know,
yeah, and
cool.
That's something that with... that they talked about very specifically, even with the Karma, even though it is bigger, it's still very small. Like, you can easily fit that in like any day pack.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that one of the designers talked about, is they wanted the mindset to be with the Karma, not should I bring the Karma along, why wouldn't I bring the Karma along, mm-hmm. was what they were going for.
Yeah. To Ben's point about bringing it up a mountain, when I was getting one of the pickup shots for Don out in Colorado, I did bring that case kind of up a mountain.
You did quite a hike.
Yeah,
you did a hike with that.
There aren't any wheels on it, so I'm just lugging this thing up a hill, bushwhacking it, trying to get
there are wheels on that case.
Well, okay, fine, but it was like a dirt gravelly path.
Yeah, that's true. No, yeah, it was, that would just be a pain.
Yeah, so for me, it really comes down to ease of use, which I think we've covered, but also camera quality. We're all familiar with Adam from the 405th. He's does a lot of wedding photography. I think, yeah, he got a Karma. I don't know if he got a Mavic, but he does have a lot of Phantoms. He needs both the wider angle lens of a GoPro and one other bit of functionality that is specific for Phantom. So he likes both. For me, I like the image quality of the Hero 5 better, but I'm not such a fan of the wide angle lens, just from like a cinematic perspective.
Yeah, it's a bit distorted, yeah. And it can take away.
But I definitely, the first time I saw the footage from the Mavic, I wasn't too impressed, I guess. It didn't look great.
Yeah, the camera isn't, as I said, that's why I think in many ways, though it has some great features, like the it can detect walls and ceilings as far and collision avoidance stuff, and has like it can go like 7 kilometers or something ridiculous. But yeah, I think that the camera is definitely from a lower end.
It's not, I don't think it's as good as the one on ours, I guess, the Phantom 3.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. But so yeah, it really depends on what you're looking for. Obviously you can't buy the Karma right now, but when it's out, that's an option. It has cool functionality, like we said, like you can take the camera off and go do other GoPro
really
stuff
flexible
with
it.
Yeah, exactly. And then the Mavic's tiny, good introductory level drone. Way better than like the what's the one? The Parrot or the
tiny one? The Parrot drones are those were some of the first and like the really, really accessible as far as from a price range.
They're they're consumer oriented.
But yeah, the when you look at these newer drones, the amount of footage you can get, even when you deal with some of the red tape, is like FCC, like you know, though technically they could go to like a kilometer up if you wanted to. You're legally, you can't go more than 400 feet.
Yeah.
With 500 feet being the absolute limit, though you're technically not supposed to go that high.
Right. Which brings us into the last bit we should mention. You got your drone. You picked out which one you want based on the camera, the flight functionality, all that. You need to know some rules, how to fly this thing legally. And David is the master of all things FCC related.
Oh, yes.
FAA or whatever that.
FAA. Yeah, that's Did I say FCC?
No, I said FCC.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
So what do people need to know, David, when they're flying?
So there's all sorts of rules from the FAA about how and when you fly. As we've mentioned earlier, one of the big ones is you can only go to 400 feet, with 500 feet being the true ceiling for... I don't remember what the term, but basically, if you're not like an actual airplane, you can't go above 500 feet. But 400 feet is what they say. They also say you should not ever fly over people or where it could fall and hurt people. Mm-hmm. So you should be doing it, you know, not in Times Square.
Right.
Though people have done it. I'm not advocating in any way.
So these are just guidelines up to this point.
Well, they're guidelines. They're guidelines. Whereas if you break these guidelines, you get slapped with like a $250,000 fine.
Oh, yikes!
Or something. So, you know, you're not advocating in any way that you do not follow the FAA's rules. Also, if your drone does not have lights on it, then you can only fly during daylight hours. So you cannot fly in dusk or dawn at all. You have to fly during daylight. But if you do have lights, like the DJI drones all have lights, they have those red and green lights on them, then you can fly in dusk and dawn times. But you still can't, by FAA rules, you cannot fly at night.
Okay.
At all. And
have to register your drone too with the FAA.
Yep. And there's some... Yes, you should register your drone. There's some weirdness where that rule might change if your drone weighs less than 10 pounds.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. It's new legislation tied to FAA budget bill in Congress, and I don't think that's gone through yet, and yeah.
Is the implication if it's under 10 pounds, you're more of a hobby drone flyer?
Something like that. I don't know. I think it may have come from also from the idea of wanting, you know, it's a new evolving market of use. Like people, like not only for filmmaking, that people want to use drones, like realtors want to use it for tours, like house tours. Like when you're doing footage, you're trying to sell a house. Do you want to be, if they have a big ground, do you want to do these sweeping shots where you get a sense of how big the grounds are? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of farmers that really, really want to use them or hire people to use them to fly over their fields so they can look and analyze what sections of the field are or are not getting enough water. Mm-hmm. So they can more effectively allocate water instead of having to do blankets, just do it everywhere.
I think this is the first time where, maybe not the first time, but I think this time around, the government's trying to get ahead of the industry when it comes to making laws for restricting this stuff. When, like, you look at the internet, government's, like, kind of really behind a lot of that stuff. I think this is the time they're trying to get ahead of the technology.
Yeah, and then the last thing is insurance is right. A big thing. Is technically, if you're going to be a flying drone, you need to have insurance to do it. I don't remember what all the exact requirements of it are. I was just trying to find it, and I cannot find it.
Is it just like basic liability in case you hit someone or something like that?
Yes, however, most insurance places, if you say you want coverage for a drone, they'll say no.
Huh.
Because the risks are too high, I think, and in the variance of what could go wrong.
Right.
You know, it could be it falls from 10 feet and somebody gets a little cut on their head because a rotor hit, or it drops from 400 feet and it hits somebody in the head, causes a spinal injury, and now you got, you know, something like that. You know.
Okay, so it's chiefly geared towards personal injury if it hits you. It's not like... Like, and probably personal property damage too, I'm guessing, right?
Yeah, probably something like that. Yeah. And I was trying to find it, but I can't find the article anymore. But there was a company that was going to be coming out with basically temporary drone insurance, mm-hmm. That would get you all the technical legal coverage you need, and you basically pay for it by the hour. So you don't have it all the time, so you don't need to have to deal with, you know, a huge, you know, monthly or half or semi-annually insurance policy.
Yeah.
It was like, okay, you know you're going to be filming out at this location from, you know, 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. Okay, it's $20 an hour, and you get your $1 million in liability coverage on your property or whatever.
Wow,
I was trying
deal.
To find it, and I can't find it, so maybe maybe that's going away. It was an app one, though.
Oh, sure.
Like, I don't even know if they had an actual website, if it was just you go to their app for the phone.
Okay, well, we got to move on. But so that's hopefully a good introductory crash course discussion on what drone you should lean towards based on your style and your level of expertise. When we come back, we're going to be talking about blending practical effects with CGI. Stay with us. So CGI, a very important and powerful tool in the realm of filmmaking. However, as we've seen in the last few decades, it can be used for great good and great evil. starting first and foremost with everyone's favorite, the Star Wars Special Edition, which was first on VHS.
And by favorite, you mean worst.
Yes, the worst thing.
The worst.
The abomination. I grew up with the pre-Special Edition VHS set, and so I didn't know about those editions until much later in my life. And it's funny, when it came out, I think I was around 10 or something like that. Yeah, I was like 98. And I was upset at first because I was like, oh, we won't have the latest, the greatest version. Mom, can we get it? And she's like, no. So I was like, oh, I got to stick with these crappy versions. But now it's like the version everyone wants. Like basically the theatrical version, essentially.
You can still get them on DVD, I think. You can go on eBay and
you
find
them. You can, and they're usually hundreds of dollars.
Yeah.
Because they are hard to find.
So the scene that we kind of chatted about before we started recording was the special edition scene
in A New Hope.
In A New Hope, that they put in where in the beginning when Luke and Obi-Wan, Chewie, and Han are trying to flee Mos Eisley on Tatooine, before they take off, Han walks to the Millennium Falcon and Jabba the Hutt is there. In all his CG glory, waiting for him.
His sluggage CG glory.
I think he has like a total of like 18 pixels making up his body. Yeah. It's pretty grotesque, I'll say.
Yeah. With Star Wars, a lot of these changes came across over many years, like with many different theatrical releases adding different things, and then the release of the Home Bible Special Edition was all of these things. In one of the way earlier ones, Jabba the Hutt was a guy.
Oh, that's
originally,
right.
He was just going to be a human or a humanoid looking guy. And then it was later, I think, by the time that then when
Jedi came out.
Yeah, Jedi came out. Then it sort of changed back.
Yeah.
They changed it to be the sluggy form. So I think they were also covering up a guy with the CG in this scene.
And what's so weird is we all know how Jabba looks in Return of the Jedi. Big, sluggish, grotesque, like, puppet, basically, is what it was, right?
Yeah, I think it was. It's three guys inside of him. Yeah,
and it was, it's cool. Like, it,
it looks
really
phenomenal.
Cool. And so when they tried to bring in this really subpar CG, it's like, you just, you didn't do it. You didn't do it right. This isn't good. If you haven't seen it, I encourage you to look it up on YouTube real quick, just like A New Hope, Jabba, or something like that. You'll find it. What were you saying, Ben?
Well, when they have Han just kind of move over the tail, that is kind of like picking
and he like does a little hop up and over.
Yeah.
That, to me, makes a lot more sense if it was supposed to be a guy, because like I feel like if they knew Jabba was going to have a tail that he would walk over, they would have had like something for, you know, for Han to step on.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, they like digitally cut him out and had him like hop over the tail. It was really weird. It reminded me, like, this is still an egregious offense, but it's not quite as bad. The whole thing where Han's head like shoots to the side when Greedo shoots first.
Really?
Yeah, his head like goes bloop into the side.
Oh, no.
It's bad. Yeah, so that's another example of bad CG. It's like, at that point, you're just nitpicking for no reason. It's it's not good.
Well, it's interesting that scene, and this is a little off topic, but there's one of the lines I think Han gives in that scene is the exact same line he tells Greedo later on.
Wait, which one?
I forget exactly what the line is. It's something about like over, maybe it's not over my dead body or something like that. But there's a line in that scene where it's the exact same thing that he says to Greedo like a little later on.
Sure. Yeah. So that's the first one that comes to mind. Later on in the 90s, when CG really picked up, actually, no, it was probably like 2000, early 2000s, because The Matrix did blend CG pretty well, I would argue, with real life. Like the first Matrix, in 1998, they had CG for like when Neo first takes the red pill and he touches the mirror, and the mirror like glops onto his body. Mm-hmm. And like that was CG, and I think really well done CG. It was reminiscent of Terminator 2, you know.
Yep. And I also feel like with this whole conversation of blending CG and practical is a lot of times it's, I think what may come in subconsciously is what also makes it bad in the blending is when it takes you out of the moment.
Exactly.
And with that one, it doesn't take you, like, because if you look at it now with our modern look at it, like, we know, like, modern day CGI would look, you know, a million times better if you were to redo it, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't take you out of the moment. It works because you are engrossed in the story and what's happening to him.
And it's tastefully used.
It is tastefully used and done. It's limited. And it works with the visual style. The other CG they used, I think they used like matte paintings and stuff for like the fields of pods and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But like, that works just fine. I think the mood they set is great. The other thing I'm thinking of is when Neo tries to make the jump and he fails and he's falling, and he does like a little like Bugs Bunny style into the concrete. I mean, it's CG, but again, like, it doesn't take you out of the moment. And we understand too that it's a computer simulation, so kind of goes with it. The contrast with that is its sequel that came out, I think, three years later. The Matrix Revolutions, or Reloaded.
Well, we can talk about the bad CG in that one too. Yeah. But yeah, with Reloaded.
Yeah, Reloaded. The one that comes to mind more than any other example in that movie is CG Neo.
Yeah,
there's so much
in Burly Brawl.
There's so much of that movie where he's flying around or fighting all those ancient Smiths, where they cut together like back-to-back shots of fully CG Neo and Smiths and then live action, and it's so noticeable. It's different.
Jarring.
It's very jarring. And that is an example of unseamless CGI that takes you out of the moment. And the filmmakers were so obsessed with trying to get, we're trying to like show a fight that you couldn't physically like film, I guess, with conventional means, that they like lost sight of trying to integrate their visual style and keep people like engrossed in the scene.
Yeah, well, there's also a lot of other problems too that take you out of that movie. But
like what, David?
Plot.
The old problem of plot.
And that one, and you can also see with it also, there's the uncanny valley effect when you're looking at CG, and there's, you know, like the more subtle uncanny valleys, like, you know, a lot of the times they talk about eyes and the way that humans' eyes move, we have a really hard time replicating how they look. But another thing from that same movie is there's the whole highway chase scene, which was, you know, it was cool how much of that was actually real, and you know, but there was a whole lot that wasn't. And at the very end of that, when the two semis collide and then Neo grabs Trinity and the Keymaker.
Morpheus.
Morpheus.
Okay, whoever it was, he grabs them and like he does like this weird twirl, and his arms go really weird as he's doing this. You can't see me in the podcast, of course, but I'm making it really funny. Look it up on
YouTube.
It's
hilarious.
It's really weird looking.
Look David up on YouTube doing that thing.
Yeah.
But also, I don't know how slowed down that's supposed to be, but I assume that Neo is moving at least the speed of sound.
Yeah.
Like, if he's jump...
Well, it'd have to be faster because, like, practically all of the flames stop.
Yeah.
Well, and the light...
They're moving slow. Yeah. Like, you can even see, like, the speed at which the semi-trailers crumple.
Yeah.
Like, down their shell. So, Neo flies in, grabs the Keymaker and Morpheus, and then shoots straight up. That would probably, like, break both their spines.
Yeah, no, they're all dead.
Yeah, or at least rip their clothes or something. Like, that's... He is exerting a force on them that would, like... destroy them. Yeah. But I mean, it's the Matrix, whatever.
So we talked about some bad CG.
Yeah.
Into some blending, bad blending.
Yes. And again, please look it up on YouTube, the Matrix Reloaded Morpheus fight. Well,
the Burly Brawl.
Yeah, the Burly Brawl.
That's what it's called.
I swear, there's a part in that fight where Neo grabs one of the Smiths, chucks it into the group of other Smiths, and it's the sound of bowling pins falling.
Yeah, no, I think it is,
yeah. and the rag doll effect that was really
And it's
bad.
Interesting, too, because I don't think it's just like the fact that it's an emerging technology when it's like that young. Because like when you look at the Lord of the Rings, that has some really great CGI shots that don't seem
And that's from
place.
The same time period. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think it was 2003 that... Revolutions came out, or Reloaded. One of those two came out in 2003.
And that's when Return of the King would have come
out. That's when Return of the King came out.
And so we know that at that era, it was possible to beautifully blend practical effects, bigatures, and CG.
Yeah.
Could be done brilliantly.
Yeah. Well, it's blending in Lord of the Rings, where it's like in the Matrix, it's like relying. When you look at some of the, like when you look at the difference between Lord of the Rings and say like the Hobbit, all of the orcs and everything in the Lord of the Rings, they're all
the up close ones, unless you're real far away,
it's costumes and
prosthetics. Whereas with Reloaded, you know, they went full CG Neo, which we weren't there yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's a good example. So moving ahead, last year Mad Max came out to like mass critical acclaim.
Yep.
Love that movie.
A large part of the buzz around that movie, everyone, including me, we were praising the practical effects in that movie. But later on, we saw a behind-the-scenes video or a series of behind-the-scenes videos that showed, actually, a lot of what we thought were practical effects were actually digital, but blended so well with what was happening on screen that it was indistinguishable. And we're talking about the big car chases, the action scenes where cars are blowing up and people are dying. It's blended flawlessly, I would argue.
Yep. No, it's great. Like, one of the ones that blew my mind the most is in... There's many... many of the chases are down a canyon in it. And some of the stuff they did shoot in a canyon. But a lot of times when a car blew up, they couldn't do it in a canyon because I'm sure for a lot of safety reasons. You have a car flying off, now it's hitting a wall and it's bouncing in unpredictable ways. Mm-hmm. They shot that in an open desert, blew it up, and then beautifully put the canyon back in such a way you have no idea that this real explosion that did happen was shot in a desert probably, you know, who knows how far away.
Right.
And now it's in a canyon.
Yeah. The biggest moment that I could tell was CG but didn't really care was the sandstorm that they drive into in the beginning. Yeah, obviously, like, it's so fantastical, it just doesn't look real, but that doesn't matter because it still looked convincing.
Mm-hmm.
So, despite it being noticeable CG, that didn't draw me out. But, yeah, like you said, David, a lot of the work going into the chase scenes of taking elements, pulling them out, putting them back in, rearranging it. Yeah, it was so effective.
Yeah, and another one similar to that is, you know, a lot of times when they needed to blow up a car, they couldn't have it, you know, even if it's in the movie, it looks like it's only 20 feet away from another vehicle. They can't blow it up that close, again, safety things. So, like, there are ones where, like, they're all driving, but the spacing is just off.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple of the cars are further away. They blow up one, and then in the movie, they slid them back closer together.
Yeah, that makes sense. To me, the only effect that I care about that was real was the flamethrower guitar player.
Oh, so good.
Yeah.
The epic bard, just like that. This is epic bard.
These are like going into battle. Yeah. Ben, what about you? What was one of your favorite moments?
I love specifically CGI moments or just like in that movie
in general. But centered around CG.
Centered around CG.
That is what we're talking about.
Yeah. I think just the moment where they go into the sandstorm and they have the epic stuff going on, like all the lightning and everything like that, mm-hmm. and they cut back to the war boy where he's like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. This is the greatest day ever kind of
what
thing.
What a lovely day.
It really sets the tone for like the way that these people look at this
bat
world.
Bat shit crazy? Yeah, they're all freaking insane. It's kind of a cool setting.
I love how they
have
just so many
world.
Great wide establishing shots in that yeah. movie. They're just great.
Which, oh man, I know we're jumping topics, but I wanted more of those in The Force Hateful Awakens, Eight? But that's a talk for another time.
So
I mean, we're kind of...
Well, real quick on that, though, Force Awakens, that is another great blending.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Because, yeah. you know, J.J. Abrams talked about how much he wanted to do things practically and that kind of thing. And, but, you know, it was with anything with limitations and whatnot. Like, they did a lot of set extensions, which I think is one of the good effective uses of CG is to do set extensions.
I think the CG in Force Awakens was staggeringly good, especially in the final fight scene between Kylo Ren and Rey, where they're in the woods, which I guess was, like, largely fake.
Yeah, I think some of the really close trees are real, but I think it's all like blue screen or green screen in the way back until they extend
and
the forest
I
out.
I didn't even slightly suspect that it was blue screen. It was good.
Well, I think like some of the actors did a really good job too. Like when you look at the moment where they're emerging from Maz's temple and Finn's like, "What do? I don't have a weapon." Like he's doing all the like arm movements that Maz is actually like moving his hand.
Yeah,
and you can't even tell. He just does it so flawlessly.
Yeah, it was good. I think J.J. Abrams was very sensitive to what fans wanted as far as what they want to be practical and remind them of old, but also like new and moving things forward.
Yeah,
as South Park pointed out.
One of the things I also really like another thing about I think bad unseamless CGI in a very modern film is in Star Wars though Phasma's cape she has that cape the silver stormtrooper her cape's real. If you look at almost all the superhero movies right now, almost all of their capes are completely fake.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's something with some of the action scenes. Like if you look at some of the behind the scenes from Batman v Superman, you look at some of the big fight scenes with Batman. He has no cape. He has like some tracking dots on his shoulders, and I wonder if some of it might be like with the speed that he needs to do the action. They are worried from a safety standpoint of someone getting caught up or stuck in it.
No capes.
No capes for you.
But yeah, like that's one thing.
Oh, yeah,
like, it looks really bad.
Incredibles.
Yeah, that's one thing I don't like with all these. Like it looks so bad. That like it's it looks, you know, fabric simulation is a very hard thing to do in CG, but it all looks so bad to me.
Maybe they gave Phasma a real cape because she wasn't really doing that much action.
No, that's absolutely true. I was just using that as my segue into capes.
But to sum up, so clearly you know, there's examples of good and bad CGI almost following to a T how far the technology has come. Like you can determine whether or not it's going to be good or bad. If you go back further, it's bad. If it's newer, it's typically better. But not always the case. Obviously, it's all about being effective and not drawing your audience out of the story. We're currently doing some CG for our Dawn Under Heaven film. And so we're going to try and implement the effective CG as best we can.
Yep. Well, and a lot of it is, you know, when you're doing from an indie perspective, a lot of times, like in many ways, it is cheaper to do green screen or to do fake stuff because you know, you can just, rather than having to spend $800 building a set like we did for some of our stuff, you can do it digitally. However, like, you know, for us, it's so much more effective and how we wanted to do it that it was just better. Like, let's just spend the $800 and we're going to build the Pelican Bay.
Yeah.
So they,
or
we
half
actually,
of it.
Yeah, half
it.
Of it. Yep.
And then get fancy with our trick photography.
Yeah, we do some fun tricks there. But, you know, that kind of, you know, some of it has to come down to your budget, but also it is, will having to use CG or take away from the story,
right,
and from the characters and what we should be caring about? Because I can't think of any now, but I'm sure there are films where that have bad CG, but I don't care.
Yeah.
Because the story, like I'm so engrossed in the characters and the story that you can just move past it.
Right. And so that's almost the hierarchy that you should typically try to adhere to. Story first, CG. Yeah, try and do that too.
Yeah.
So when we come back, we'll be talking about Fantastic Beasts and where to find them. Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them.
Yeah, that was interesting. They started. They
I don't like that they started with that. Yeah. I think that was a very poor choice. They started with Hedwig's theme for the title thing. Like, this should be your place to put in a new theme.
Not as poor of a choice as using the Ringwraith music
for Thorin.
This is true. But yeah, so J.K. Rowling helped write the script. If I'm not mistaken,
I don't think she even helped write. She was the screenwriter. Yeah, I think she was main credited screenwriter for it.
So this film takes place in the 1920s after World War One in New York City, where Newt Scamander, Hogwarts expulsion,
expulsee.
No,
he didn't drop out. He was expelled.
Yep,
expulsee.
Well, wait, how could he have been? Because they didn't snap his wand. They snap your wand when you get expelled from Hogwarts. Interesting.
I don't know, but this is, somehow he ended up with
there's a hole
one.
In this story. Yeah.
Well, I mean, he probably just got another one somehow. He's a crafty gentleman.
He is.
So he's, but he's much older now. This is I'm guessing he got expelled.
At the latest at 17, he's probably late 20s.
Yeah. So this was 30s. Before World War One. World War One happened. He worked with dragons or something in Eastern Europe, and now he's.
Yeah, I need to want to come back to that.
Okay.
Later.
Okay. All right. We will. But anyway, now he has a case full of magical critters, which also basically doubles as a bag of holding if you play D&D.
Yeah.
And he brings it to New York with the intent of releasing this incredible bird,
beast.
Yeah,
Thunderbird.
In Arizona. So that's what his mission is. And he gets hung up in New York because there's some crazy stuff going down.
Yeah.
First impressions, guys. Ben, what'd you think?
I thought it was entertaining.
Oh, how do you compare it to last episode's Doctor Strange?
Oh, better. Definitely better.
I agree.
Yeah.
I liked it.
He liked it.
I liked it. You know, I wouldn't, you know, it's not stunning and amazing. I wouldn't hold it up to Lord of the Rings or something, but I did like it for the most part.
Yeah, I did too. And you know, this is an important point, I would say. The Harry Potter movies aren't 10 out of 10s, you know. They're a good attempt at trying to stay faithful to the books while incorporating some new imaginative visuals and stuff.
And you know what's interesting with that also is I think people were talking about with the appeal of Fantastic Beasts, and the interesting thing is in some ways this movie is not for kids.
Right. And this
is
kids.
This is for us.
Yeah.
This is for us who grew up with it. And I think that's also going to be an interesting thing to see because my mom, who works in an elementary school, made an interesting point about Harry Potter in the first place. You know, did you guys read it growing up?
Yeah.
This is like our story.
Yeah. For us, it was interesting because we literally grew up with Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
We aged with him in real life. And, you know, we waited a year or two between books to do that. But nowadays, you know, someone wants to read, they just get all of them.
Yeah.
You know, they'll read all 7 books in 2 months.
Yeah.
And so I think that's going to be interesting with this one because I've also said that Newt Scamander may not be the main character in all of the Fantastic Beasts movies.
That's right, because is it a trilogy?
There's going to be 5 total.
Oh, wow.
So this is one. So yeah, they went up from 3 to 5. I think they announced that about a month ago.
Because more money.
Money.
It's going to be 7 soon.
Yeah, I can see it now. Fantastic Beasts 2, the switch for more money.
Exactly. Needed merchandise. I'd buy that scarf. But yeah,
I want his coat.
With the exception of the orphans, there's not really any children in this movie.
Nope. No. Yeah. It is. And you can also see that there is not outright there. There is more sexuality in it. You know, there's some allusions to that.
Some. Not an overt.
No. Not an overt. Just like sort of the subtle jokes that again, it's some Disney humor.
Yeah.
Where like the kids won't notice, but
the mom or the foster mom beating all the kids.
There's child abuse.
Like, here, give me your belt. Like what?
Yeah. I mean, there's some dark stuff in the later Harry Potter movies too.
Sure, but if we're talking about the whole growing up kind of thing, like. That's a pretty dark thing.
Yeah.
But again, it's not 4K. This is for us. Mm-hmm. This is for we're adults now. So this movie is almost perfectly geared towards us.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit younger, but not much.
It was really interesting seeing some of the cultural differences in America's wizarding world versus the UK is.
And that's another thing that I thought was done quite effectively, which I think a lot of movies don't do this anymore. But you can see this kind of thing in Star Wars and in The Last Starfighter, movies like that. We have a character we can immediately relate to. We sort of relate to two characters in here as audience members. We relate to Newt a bit because he comes from Europe. He is, so we know the European wizarding
he's
community
from Hogwarts,
well. He knows he's from Hogwarts. He works for the Ministry of Magic. We know that. So he's our one end. So we have that grounding there. Then we have, I can't remember the guy's name, but the Muggle, the nomad that that he meets at the very beginning.
Yeah. What is his name?
What is his name? Ben, look up his name. he's Hutch from in Fanboys, if anyone has seen that movie.
Oh, it's Dan right.
Folger. Dan Folger.
I knew I recognized him.
And I got to say, I think he's a great actor. I'm so glad to see him in another movie.
I thought he did a great job in this movie.
But yeah, he was another character because he is our fish out of water.
Yeah.
He is a person who knows absolutely nothing. And so things get to be explained to him.
Uh-huh.
And I think for the most part, relatively effective ways that are not too super overt. And then that is thusly explaining to us, the audience, those things. So I think that was effectively done. And I think a lot of movies don't give us a character like that.
I think that they had a great partnership, a great duo in the movie. With, like, for example, one of my favorite scenes when they were trying to capture that giant rhinoceros thing that broke into the zoo. And he kept handing pieces of armor to him. And he was like, why do I have to wear this helmet? Because your skull is susceptible to breakage under immense pressure.
Oh, yours isn't?
And he's about to capture the thing. He's getting really close. And all of a sudden, like, the dude puts on all that, like, pheromone stuff.
Yeah.
And the thing's like, like, do me.
and that scene, that's another one where something that I think should have been done up just a hair more is, I feel like too often with Newt, he comes across a little green still.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with how he interacted with other wizards and other humans in general. Mm-hmm. You can see he's sort of an awkward guy. He does not have fantastic social skills. But we see his brilliance come out with creatures, with magical creatures. That was a great scene when he's doing the mating dance. I thought that was really a lovely, really great scene. I wish there were just a couple more moments, like not super long, not as long, but a few more moments where we can really see why this character is so good and so great of a wizard.
Yeah, for me, go to that point, the movie really didn't pick up, didn't really get going until the scene where he first steps into the case. I felt like up till then he was, I didn't really understand it, what was going on. It felt kind of slow. You know, Newt was being very quiet and reserved, like more so than in the later part of the film. You know, when the female lead, I'm really bad with names today on these characters, but when she takes him into the to
Queenie,
or what is Queenie? The sister.
Yeah.
When she takes her, oh, is it Tina?
Maybe that.
When she takes Newt in to be arrested, basically, and then they go to her place and da 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 and all this stuff, like that whole thing, it was fine. It felt a little slow, and then she brings in the cocoa, and then the whole time Newt is just awkwardly laying in bed like you can see this look of anxiousness on his face. He's like, all right, thank you, good night, goodbye. The moment the door closes, he gets up, goes into his case, and he's like, all right, time to get to work. And I'm like, okay, I'm in. I'm into the story now. This is finally going somewhere.
Well, it wasn't really, like, for me, the story seemed a little weird. And it's like, what is this story?
Yeah.
Are we finding these loose beasts? Or are we talking about this other villain they're trying to incorporate?
I couldn't get a feel for the story until that part happened.
Mm-hmm.
Also, this is going to be a big spoiler to anyone listening. We do spoilers.
Yeah,
yes, we do.
So this is going to be a huge spoiler. So if you are listening along, you haven't seen it yet, like skip like a minute ahead.
Or just, we'll see you next time.
Yeah, this is going to be a big one.
Come back after you watch the movie.
So the big thing is Grindelwald.
Yeah.
That's a big allusion to. We keep hearing about him in the back. And it was revealed, and it was somewhat spoiled for me as because of this, because it was revealed that Johnny Depp was going to be in later movies, is what they announced, and that he was going to be playing Grindelwald. So I was sort of looking for that in this movie the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
The haircut of Grindelwald in the opening shot, the opening scene, is the same haircut as what the bad guy at Minusca.
Colin Farrell's.
Yeah, Colin Farrell's. It's the same hair. So immediately, like, already it's like there's like, I didn't put together one to one that it was going to be Grindelwald, but that's already making him a bad guy for me.
I guess I didn't get that.
Yeah. And another thing that I think was left out, and I feel like they should have been hinted at this a bit, is in the movie you don't know with whoever Colin Farrell's character is, if Grindelwald took his place, or he built up through the ranks. I did some other research and found out he killed off that guy and then took his identity.
Oh, really?
Yep. So that was a previous character already established.
I wanted more of Colin Farrell. I actually really enjoyed him in this movie.
I liked him too. Yeah.
His outfit. Oh my God.
That was pretty cool. So I don't, as I said before, I want Newt's coat. One thing that I did like, and this is a very, very fine balance for me, and I think you guys may be on the same page with this, but we all like lore.
Yeah.
These big enveloping worlds that you can sort of get lost in. Mm-hmm. And as we've talked about, maybe we haven't really talked about it actually, but there's a whole lot of places where the lore is either non-existent where you want there to be, or sometimes it is hard to get to. Mm-hmm. A good example is the video game Destiny. Mm-hmm. There is some phenomenal lore in there, but it's hard to find it. You have to dig through, you have to go to your app, you have to look at the grimoire cards or whatnot. You have to sort of to get anything of substance. Like what they touch on in the game itself is very, very light. I think that this did a pretty good job of giving you some idea to this lore without having to go into like what you mentioned earlier with the dragons.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was that, you know, the Nomash character went and asked him like, oh, did you fight in the Great Wars? Like, oh yeah, mostly in the dragon division in Siberia or wherever it was.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's that nice little touch that makes the world a little bit bigger.
But you have to be careful though, because sometimes lore can just turn into too much exposition and just it overwhelms you.
Right, exactly. And why, to David's point, I think they did a great job. Most of the time it was just like a line here and there, like when they brought up Ilvermorny. Ilvermorny, with the American school. You know, just quick lines here and there.
Mm-hmm.
On the front of like other lore, though, one thing I was thinking about a lot is Grindelwald and how he fits in the timeline if he's already middle aged at 1926, right? Because he appears like Johnny Depp, like he's a middle aged dude.
Yeah.
So in the 7th Harry Potter, we see Grindelwald in a flashback with Harry as a boy stealing the Elder Wand. That hasn't happened yet in this Fantastic Beasts movie. So how does that make any sense? Unless he's like pretending to be an older guy.
Maybe he didn't have it. Like he didn't bring it with him. Because he would need to use the same wand that the other guy had. So maybe he intentionally doesn't have it with him.
But the other thing is, Dumbledore and Grindelwald have their famous duel in 1945. That's 20 years from this movie. Yeah.
Well, already we know, like, and do you know how old Dumbledore is in 1945?
He's probably old as fuck.
62. He's 62 already.
Okay.
When he has that.
Okay.
I was doing a bunch of this research because I was curious. Because one thing that I feel like you never got a real sense of with, like, Voldemort in the original Harry Potter is, what is his motivation? Why does he want to do all this bad stuff? You don't get that well. And so I was trying to figure that out for Grindelwald. And so with Grindelwald, his motivation is his big picture goal, or not big picture, his minor goal basically is to abolish the international statute of secrecy.
Yeah, well, he says that in the movie.
Yep. But I want to know more, like, what he really wanted with that. Like, what is he trying to accomplish?
I mean,
with
just
that
from
change?
Like a base, like, foundational emotional place. He just doesn't want to live in secrecy. He thinks wizards are superior to normal humans,
right?
And thinks that we should be above them rather than below,
right?
And it works. The metaphor works well because when he says that, they're down in the subway. So he points up. He's like, we should be above them, and he points up.
Yeah,
that comes across when he talks to Credence too. Like when Credence is not useful to him anymore.
Yeah,
like, you're a squib. You don't have magic.
It's, yeah,
yeah,
yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I guess that makes sense if Grindelwald's just as old as Dumbledore. And, like, he's also in Azkaban at the end. Like, Voldemort goes, what?
He's not in Azkaban.
Well, then where does that scene take place?
This will be another potential spoiler for people, as this, maybe you guys don't want me to say, because this is potentially what we will be seeing in the next four films.
Well, no, just explain, like, I'm talking about, like, it's the end of 7 part 1. Like the movie.
That is not Azkaban prison. He is in a prison.
Oh, is it like an American prison?
No.
Okay.
Just for the sake of...
But it looks just like Azkaban, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And I don't know, maybe for their interpretation, they put him there.
Okay.
But in my research into the lore, he is not there.
Okay, so at this point, but that basically means that, let's see, that would have been 1997, I want to say. So Grindelwald at that point is probably like 95.
Yep. And one thing that I think that's going to be interesting going forward with these films is because I think they have said that these five films are going to span about 20 years, which then would be landing us at the very end of World War II.
Yeah.
And And then I think this battle between Grindelwald and Dumbledore will be the sort of the wizard's half of World War II.
I guess what I'm just trying to square off is just the boy Grindelwald from the flashback, and then the middle-aged Johnny Depp Grindelwald we see in this movie. That just kind of was weird.
So is Harry? I don't actually know this, but is Harry Potter that book series? Is that in modern times?
That is 90 to 97.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is when that actually takes place.
And it's funny because that doesn't really. It's not really really obvious until the last book.
One thing that I have wondered with that is I wonder if J.K. Rowling. Like after the first several books came out, decided to put it there.
It's clear in book two that it's in the '90s.
Is it?
It's very subtle. I know this because I read book two this last year. When Harry Potter goes to Nicholas's death day party, the ghost, yep. Sir yep. Nicholas, it says like his like when he like how many like it says like how year, many years it's been since he died.
Okay,
and I think he died. It is 500th death day, and it was 1492.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, yeah, and one thing that it, and so then this does not fall into that because I had wondered, did she pick the 90s because nothing was going on?
Sure. And because we didn't have cell phones yet and the internet, and that wouldn't have been a complication.
Yeah, and also like because if she put it in the 2000s, she would have had to deal with September 11th.
Yeah,
and then having to work that in because that is obviously something that shook the globe, mm-hmm. and so she would then have to put that in. Yeah. So I was wondering if that's part of
it.
Anyway.
But anyway, so it, for me, it was. I first got that when Harry Potter goes to his parents' graves and see like when they died. They died in 1980.
Okay.
And
yep, and that's when he was born. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it would have been 91.
And I was like, oh, I had no idea. But it's funny because yeah, then I go back in book two and it's like, oh.
Yeah,
you know, all the signs are there. You just gotta pay close attention. Mm-hmm. So, yep. Anyway, going back to the movie.
Yeah.
Also, really good CG, really good effects.
For the most, I feel like you can definitely see the difference in the budget.
Mm-hmm.
Film, like compared to like mm-hmm. like Batman vs Superman or mm-hmm. you know or one of these other ones. Like you can definitely see where like one thing I feel like it was not done effectively though was whenever Newt had to touch a magical creature. I feel like wasn't quite right.
Yeah, it felt a lot like when Harry Potter had to touch Buckbeak or something like that.
Yeah, like it felt like whatever their stand-in is for him to touch something so that his hand didn't go into the creature, something was not quite quite square.
Maybe I just like put these films in a different place in my mind because I'm not really concerned that much with how good the CG is because like in the early Harry Potters, it wasn't phenomenal, so I'm just like, okay, yeah, it's fine, it's magic. But for the most part, yeah, I think the CG was effective.
I think it was close, because you could see his hand, like, going over the beak and everything. Like, you could see a little bit of the shape there.
But also, I want to look and see, like, how much effort was put into making New York look like 1920s.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, because I saw at the end of the credits, I was like, you know, there was, I think it was filmed a bit at, what's the studio in London, or in England? They film Star Wars there, they film... And James Bond there.
I can't think of it.
Yeah. Again, it's a very important studio. Anyway, they did a bunch there, and so I'm wondering if quite a bit of like if they really didn't build much, mm-hmm. and most of it was digital set extensions because mm-hmm. there's no place you could go on location to make it look like 1920s New York. It is a very distinct look.
I think if you compare it to like King Kong, Peter Jackson's King Kong, because that was around the same time. I think it was. A little more effective, like with its look, than that movie.
Do you think Fantastic Beasts was more effective? Yeah. Okay, yes, I agree.
Was this event the whole kind of like destruction of New York? Was this something that was alluded to before, like in the Harry Potter series at all?
I don't remember. I don't know.
Because I'm a little, they keep going back to like cities being destroyed. This is just a thing in movies in general, or like where it's just like cities are these big events, like these big destruction events are happening. And it just seems to happen all the time. Like I feel like there was this, the subtlety was gone in this movie that I appreciated in some of the earlier Harry Potters.
Sure. Oh yeah, definitely.
Because you have more that you can do with CGI. That we can do like these bigger and greater things. We can be more verbose. Yeah. But I felt like there were some moments where there was subtlety, and there was other moments where
New York has been destroyed so many times in film history.
I think though with this one, like the destruction though. It makes sense because I feel like this is also, because in the whole movie they're talking, there's obviously this whole thing about MNUSCO, which is the Magical Wizarding Congress of America, whatever the acronym is. There's this whole thing like wizards are not allowed to deal with Nomadges at all. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't marry them. You're not supposed to interact with them. Like, you're only supposed to be within the wizarding community. And I feel like, though they got away with this one, like, you know, they got to wipe everyone's memory very conveniently, and I thought obviously placed in earlier in the movie. They get, you know, this is their get out of jail free card for this. But I feel like this may be the start of a conversation, because with J.K. Rowling, what she's been writing about the wizarding world in America, which she has written about on Pottermore, the website, we really don't know. I feel like, and unless I missed a newer document that she's put out, we don't really know a lot about the wizarding world in America after this. Like, she's not released, like, she's talked about, like, how it got started here in the States and how Ilvermorny got started, but not really after this. So we don't know if there's going to be this change where it's going to be more like Europe.
Yeah.
Where, like, maybe they'll be a little more, like, you can fraternize with nomadges.
Mm-hmm.
It's also going to be interesting because I enjoyed the setting a lot. I enjoyed that, and I was I was hoping that it would stay there. But I know that they've announced that the next film is not going to be, it's back to Europe.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they're going to Paris. That's too bad.
I mean, I would be fine leaving New York because every freaking movie's in New York.
Yeah, like, I would like to stay in the States though. Yeah, I liked that.
Yeah, or maybe like, I don't know, like being able to see Ilvermorny or something,
because it's different. It provides a different perspective of like how the wizarding goes. Which is
in part why I think this movie was good, because like it showed a different side of the wizarding world, to the point of cities being destroyed. Like, we never saw London being destroyed or anything like that. It wasn't about citywide destruction. It was more about like a cultural conflict between different ideologies within the wizarding world. Overall, good movie, definitely recommend it. Go see it if you have to pick between that and Doctor Strange.
Go see this.
Yeah,
but
definitely.
You know, or see both. I would recommend both, even if I think Ben said save your money. But that is going to end episode 6 of the Indie Film Toolkit podcast. Keep making movies, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.